Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to The Inspired Evolution. I'm your humble host, Amrit Sandhu, and you're tuning in to a conscious conversation designed to help you grow. Our mission here is simple. It's for you to live your purpose, live your best life, live the life you love. This podcast is sponsored by Enthusiasm for Life, by Great Creation itself. To keep the good vibes flowing for myself and yourself, do us a solid, subscribe to the Inspired Evolution podcast on YouTube, the home of the Inspired Evolution podcast. Now sit back, relax, open your mind, open your heart to this conversation and stay inspired. Keep evolving. Welcome to the Inspired Evolution. And it is it's a treat today. We have with us Tom Chi. Tom, how are you, sir?
I'm doing good.
It is such a pleasure to have you here, brother. For those tuning into Tom for the first time, oh my God, he's an inventor, he's a leader, he's a coach, he's a speaker, he's an investor. Some of the things that really drive him is helping humanity become a net positive to nature. Imagine that for just a second. He coaches corporate executives and top investors. He strengthens social entrepreneurship. He gives talks and workshops on mindset and like the unlimited possibilities of the mind. It is such a pleasure to have you here today, Tom. Thank you so much for doing this with us.
Yeah, looking forward to it.
So I wanted to dive in really quickly. For those that identify with your work, I think are very well aware that, you know, there is a massive engineering. You're an incredible engineer. Let's put it that way. But when you dig a little bit deeper under the surface, it seems to be, and I remember asking one of my university lecturers this, and my background was in engineering as well, is that, you know, it sort of seems, especially when you look at people like Einstein, you sort of get to the point where some of the most remarkable engineers are also some of the more metaphysical thinkers. Why do you think that becomes the case?
Well, I mean, I'm formally trained in physics and electrical engineering. And I guess what physics teaches you is how to understand the entire physical world. So I think that already gets you pretty far in terms of thinking about some of the big questions. This is why, you know, some sub branches of physics, like, you know, cosmology, astrophysics, really just go to the basics, like why do we all exist and why is the universe here and how does the whole thing work? So physics, definitely. And even if you didn't do physics, engineering is a very kind of organized type of cognition. And it basically is not just organized, but it's like meant to go create something. Right. So scientists, I was also a scientist, so nothing against scientists, but scientists are mostly focused on studying the natural world in various forms and just having a consistent way of being able to go and do a type of inquiry to be able to reveal more and more about a thing that exists. Mm-hmm. But engineers need to create things that don't exist. And effectively, the cognition of being the type of cognition that allows you to be structured and principled about going from something not existing to existing is really useful for lots of things, including asking big questions about, you know, why we make what we make.
Mm. That was going to be one of the questions I was hoping to get to later in the podcast, but let's go right there. when we talk about why we make what we make, there seems to be like an incredibly rapid growth to, you know, this sort of curve to technology that we can map and model out. And it's growing really, 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 really fast compared to, you know, there's a lot of these talks around our mind is actually from a linear world. You know, you see an animal sort of speed up, slow down. It's a lot more linear than the growth of actual, like of what technology actually is. What do you feel about the, taking from what technology could potentially become versus what the human mind is actually capable to interface and interact with? Some part of me will ask about the moral obligations around some of that coming up as well. What are your thoughts around some of this?
Yeah, I mean, whenever you design or engineer anything, then there's some sort of intention in it. Sometimes I like to say that design is really just a frozen intention. And then when you go and kind of interact with it, you kind of unfreeze the intention of the designer. Same idea goes for like when you engineer something. And, you know, there are some real questions about like the intentions of what you have chosen to design, engineer, create. Mm-hmm. And I think like what has been tricky, like, you know, the way that you phrase the question is, oh, technology is, you know, going so fast, but technology is a thing that happens because of a set of decisions that we make. Mm-hmm. And because of those decisions, it means that there's intention baked into the movement of technology. So to the extent that technology is moving faster than people can get accustomed to it, it's because we decided that it should. And I think there is a element of, you know, did we make those decisions with the best intentions, right? I think a lot of times,
consciously, like, yeah.
Right. I think, you know, part of the reason that a lot of folks kind of are pushing forward this edge is that, you know, if you go faster, you can make money in less time, right? And that is not necessarily an intention to serve. Now, making money doesn't necessarily mean that you're not serving. Like, they can absolutely overlap, but it doesn't guarantee that you are serving either. And sometimes we can get into these spots. I mean, we see this especially with social media, where, yeah, there's this way of designing that technology which kind of constitutes the fastest way you can make money out of it, but maybe it's actually not the right intention to freeze. To be kind of harsh about it, like the way that I've kind of phrased how we've done a lot of the software work recently is we spent most of the 20th century figuring out how to strip mine the physical resources of the planet, and we're spending the 21st century strip mining the cognitive resources of the planet. Because social media to me is like cognitive strip mining. It wasn't necessarily your intention. There's a tension that they're stripping from you. And it's a finite resource, just like, you know, minerals in the ground. Because as much as the mind, you know, is very flexible and there's an infinite number of things that a person can think about, a person's life is still a finite number of days. And there's still a finite number of thoughts you'll have in that life. So given that there's like a finite number of people and a finite number of thoughts in a life, then that actually means it's a limited resource that we're effectively strip mining and using in a particular way that may not be in the intention of the folks that we are doing
the end user
via software.
Time and attention are very precious commodities when you put it into the context of what you're describing. And wow, that is a I'm just going to call it a bit of a harrowing metaphor. I think it's thinking about it as what we did with the physical resources and putting them into the urban environment. And obviously, as a structural engineer, I can relate to that. Thinking about what yeah, the software development and that metaphor of strip mining our cognitive resources is, yeah,
you know, like if I can see the thing is that this is not necessarily what software needs to do. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so before I worked on web software, because I worked at Yahoo and Google, but before that I worked at Microsoft, and I worked on Microsoft Office. And I would say in that team, the thing that we were thinking about all the time is, oh, here's a complex task that people are trying to get done. So they're trying to take like a set of email addresses or like, you know, customer information that's in Excel and connect it with a Word template to be able to send out these, you know, like mailers, you know, through Outlook or whatever. And we were always asking the question, like, how do we make it so it's easier for a person to do the thing that they want?
Mm-hmm. Easy.
Which is very different than the question that social media asks. Social media asks is like, well, how do I get enough behavior from you so I can get what advertisers want? Right. And this is just to say that software doesn't intrinsically need to be built off of the intention that a lot of modern software is built off of. But a lot of this kind of freemium, you know, ad-based sort of stuff, it almost has to be built off of a cognitive strip mining model. Now, when you pay for stuff, like if you pay for a little design tool, or if you pay for Netflix or whatever, they don't necessarily need to throw a bunch more ads in there and know that much about you.
Yeah.
So, these are choices that we made around the business models that we were going to, most empower. And then, we're kind of living the consequences of that strip mining right now.
What about the, tuning into some of the work that Noam Chomsky put into the world? And he talks about how we're, you know, this extinction that potentially we're facing now, and that we're so pot committed into the technological revolution that actually our decision makers are hoping, and this is how it's been in the past as well, he references actually, that we're hoping that, and we're so pot committed into technology and its advancements that we're past the point of return from where we are, that we actually hope and pray that the next technological advancement that will save us in terms of cleaning the waterways, helping us with greenhouse gases, X, Y, and Z, potentially even, you know, our relationship with attention and social media. We're waiting for the next piece of technology around the corner to come and alleviate the pains that were put in place from previous advancements. Your thoughts on us being leveraged out into technology that way?
So there's a difference between physical and psychological technologies. So like when you're talking about like, hey, you know, we make a bunch of stuff out of steel and aluminum, and there's a bunch of mining that has to happen with that. Those are physical things.
And
one can absolutely imagine that, there's a best way that we know how to do it right now. Which is actually what we are largely doing. Like people are not running crazily inefficient, you know, smelting facilities or bauxite processing facilities, you know, just for the heck of it, right? So like when you actually get a technical innovation in these sort of physical processes, they actually tend to be largely, you know, adopted reasonably quickly. And if you are kind of doing those innovations with an eye toward better environmental, you know, better relationship to the environment, then you can get a actual real, you know, win there. When what I was just saying about software is we know how to make better software than what we've made, right? So it's, we are choosing to make worse software because it's more profitable. And that's just a kind of different thing that's happening between hardware and software. And I'm not sure if that, you know, goes too much in the weeds on Noam Chomsky's point, but I think like one needs to be specific about what technology they're talking about, as opposed to just saying, oh, technology is too far gone. We don't end up having a sophisticated conversation about it if we just kind of do the broad brush strokes. But like when we do know how to do something better, but it just ends up being more profitable to do it in a worse way, then we need to look at regulation. We need to go look at kind of training ourselves in terms of our own like personal media savviness and social media savviness to be able to do kind of less of it, in the places where it won't be regulated.
Can I ask you from a social entrepreneurship bent then, do you think the future is...
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
I'm going to frame this in a really cumbersome way, but please, hopefully you can forgive me for that, but you and the listener. Social entrepreneurship. Is it going to be more profitable long-term to do things which have more positive intentions for the collective embedded in them? Or is that going to have to be a decision that we make that, hey, we forego profits for the social benefit?
Yeah, it's a whole interesting question, you know, and it could be its own like 10-hour conversation. But like the, you know, I will say that in the work that I do day to day, we are finding a bunch of things where it is much more like that first sort of win where the unit economics are better and it's way more ecologically sound, like either having way less way smaller footprint of damage or a positive generative footprint. And those are the companies that, you know, my firm invests in. And I see like a lot of potential in that kind of playing through. When it comes to, you know, some of these other things like social media, like I said, you know, you might need to go down a regulatory track for it in order to, and, you know, we've done this in the past. It's like, you know, car companies were like, well, adding seatbelts costs us some money. And then we were kind of like, you know, actually, we should probably add seatbelts, though. Like, I know it costs you like a little bit more money, but it's probably worth it, right?
Hashtag worth it.
Right. So, yeah. And we are actually seeing that in a number of other places, like this, for example, like HFCs. So fluorinated gases are thousands of times more greenhouse gas warming than carbon dioxide. And they can last in the atmosphere, you know, tens of thousands of years, some of them 100,000 years. So, like, we should really get a hold of them, but we're mostly using them in our air conditioners and refrigerators right now. And in the US, we just passed a law that was aiming to go phase out by more than 90%, you know, HFCs, which is the kind of main class of refrigerant that we're using. So that's another example of a case where it's like, yeah, regulation steps in. It basically says, hey, you know, for the greater good, and in this case, you know, with greenhouse gases, a particular type of greenhouse gas in mind, then it's like, let's just get off of using HFCs. Let's get something else in place that has way smaller warming footprint. Because if you're warming the planet, trying to cool yourself down with an air conditioner, it's like, well, that sounds a little futile.
Yeah, and a bit of a spiral out of control. Literally,
so. Yeah, because there's going to be, 2 billion more air conditioners sold in the next couple of, you know, decades, because both rising incomes and just rising temperatures around the world.
Yeah. It was pretty fascinating. This is totally left brain, but when I was working on one of my theses, one of the interesting things I found, just air conditioners, this triggered sort of this conversation, was I found that the urban heat island effect is actually pretty interesting, because there are some cities which are naturally cooler, but they end up warmer and more inhabitable because they go up by temperature, which is actually, anyway, that was just something that I found sort of off topic, off charts, but really interesting, because most of the world, obviously, that as you get close to the equator, is actually struggling with the urban heat island effect, but there are some random cities that actually do better. One of the questions I've got, Tom, is, this is completely left field, but it's you. So I really wanted to dive into the opportunity to ask you this question. The the sort of biblical saying that we are made in the image of God. And when I unpack that personally, and feel free to unpack this in your own way, and please do, is, you know, we are creators in many ways, and, you know, God is potentially a creative force, and we're here to, I find ourselves creating as scientists, as engineers, you know, even social entrepreneurs. So if we are creating the image of God, and it seems to be that there is currently this new evolution towards pushing for the development of information intelligence, artificial intelligence, IT intelligence. What does that say about the nature of our reality, in your opinion? Do you think, even maybe potentially gleaning into some of that Elon Musk conversation around what he said, that this is unlikely, that this is base reality, are we living in a simulation? It's probably too left field a question, but what do you think the us being creators and the way we're creating technology reflects about our mind and the way we are as creators? Have you contemplated this? I'm sure you have.
Yeah, of course. I think most of the conversation that we're having in this era about it is people that do computer science basically thinking that what they do is way more important than it is. Mm-hmm. And because, like, you know, honestly, if you're a computer scientist, it would be amazing if the world was a simulation. It's something that you know how to work with, right? Like, people know how
controllable
to, right, variables, they know how to program valuable. Unity or Unreal Engine or like whatever. Mm-hmm. Right. So like, I think that this would be the case of a bunch of folks in a particular profession really wanting the world to work in a particular way. Now, I'm a physicist as well, and the world's not a simulation. The universe is not a simulation. So the fact that, you know, these people are having any sort of extended conversation about them, well, to be so dumb for so long takes actual effort, right? So like, there either needs to be, you must be going for an actual effort to be this dumb so long, or there must be a benefit for that statement possibly being true to you. And I think about that as much more of a psychological doldrum that these folks have kind of argued themselves into to magnify their own importance. In practice, like, artificial intelligence today is pretty garbage. It's super dumb. Like, other than, you know, a couple very specialized cases, like a game like chess or Go, where the rules are very well defined, kind of the parameter space, you know, is combinatorially large, but like, it's honestly quite small compared to reality, then like, artificial intelligence does quite well in those settings, but that's not really anything like the real world. So I think we're just getting a little bit ahead of ourselves in terms of you know, how smart this stuff is. Now, it doesn't mean that it's that there aren't dangers. But the dangers are not that it's going to get too smart. The dangers are that we will put it into positions of too much power while it's dumb. And actually, this is already happening right now. Like, the most sophisticated artificial intelligence in the world today are trading stocks and serving you ads. Those are the actual most sophisticated artificial intelligences in the world. That's where they're deployed. And right now, both of those are destabilizing society because we put them in too large a position of power. Trading stocks basically means that it affects the value of our markets a consequential way. And, you know, serving you ads actually means, serving ads means it actually consequentially affects our psychologies. And it's like, okay, well, so artificial intelligence is dangerous not because it's getting generally intelligent and it's going to make some decisions against us. It's, you know, artificial intelligence is dangerous because dumb people put it into places where it didn't belong, and it's actually not smart. Like, this is why we can have a flash crash where the value of coffee beans, like, worldwide crashes by 75% in 100 milliseconds. You know, is it that somehow over 100 milliseconds that everybody in the world was like, oh, we don't like coffee anymore, and that's why the price went down? Of course not. There was, like, no physical value change in the actual real world that happened. But these smart AI algorithms basically dueled each other at this high frequency trading and basically ran down the price or ran up the price, I mean, in these various ways, which basically actually hurt people's lives in real life.
In physical, tangible outcomes, yeah.
Right, because if you were a coffee farmer, and a lot of coffee farmers live on $1 to $5 a day, mm-hmm. and you're around harvest time period, and you've put all this money into your crop, and you mm-hmm. really, and like harvest time period is like the one time of the year where you make back all that money, and then you happen to have a big flash crash, you know, the week that you're harvesting, then you've actually damaged people's lives. It's not just a fun game, you know, like GameStop or whatever. Mm-hmm. So this is us basically ruining the world through artificial intelligence, but not because AI is actually intelligent. It's because mm-hmm. we're dumb, or we're acting dumb with the AI that we have. And this is the danger of like letting the folks have that conversation so long, where they're kind of, you know, waxing poetic about how smart they are and how smart the AI is, and maybe we're on a simulation. That's us kind of like
giving it too much credit.
The wrong people, yeah. right? And like yeah. not actually calling them on a bunch of bad decisions that are already in play.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is going to be one of the questions I ask, but I feel like you've spoken to it already, is the fear that we have potentially around artificial intelligence development. But I love the way you articulated that, which is, you know, it's not that it has corrupt intentions. It's just that it's not intelligent enough to do the functions that we're asking it to perform, and yet we're putting it in places of power where it can perform said functions.
Yeah, AI is just another tool, like a hammer, and every tool, there's a moral responsibility to go use the tool well. Like with a hammer, you can build houses, you can, you know, you can go construct things that matter, and you can also bash people's heads in. And there's nothing about the tool by itself that basically says how you'll use it. Mm-hmm. But, you know, what we have basically allowed is we have basically allowed unfettered use of every tool that exists in the world without, mm-hmm. and we basically chalk it up to, well, it's the invisible hand of the free market. So like, it's just going to do what it does. But the free market is also another tool. Like mm-hmm. just because you're using the free market as a tool doesn't mean that you've abdicated your moral responsibility to use it, you know, kindly, wisely, you know, in search of, you know, benefit to humanity and for purpose, right? Mm-hmm. And we've basically made capitalism into like a religion. It's like worshiping a hammer. And we basically said, well, if the market said this, then that's the truth. It's like, no, guys. No, you basically just abdicated your moral responsibility to use capitalism wisely. And for me, capitalism is just a synonym for the phrase make sufficient. And you can go and make terrible things efficient, and you can make amazing things efficient. So capitalism by itself is not necessarily intrinsically terrible, but it is practically terrible in this age because we have abdicated our moral responsibility in the application of it as a tool, and we've elevated it to the kind of status of effectively its own god or religion. Like when you see like people in government that are very pro-capitalist or neoliberal, you know, kind of economics type folks, then they basically kind of treat the invisible hand as if it's its own god. And it's like, you're not meant to worship tools. Let's just be clear about it. And capitalism is not even an ideology, right? Like an ideology like actually imparts values, right? Like, we're blowing it super bad on this one.
Yeah, sorry, I shouldn't laugh. It's definitely not funny. It's just, the consequences of us blowing it super bad on just this one is collectively such a consequence. It's it's not funny.
No, I think it's a fine reaction. And and it's very, you know, sometimes it's frustrating to watch, you know, these politicians go and make that case. Because it's like, wow, I mean, if you just understand it's a tool, like everything that you just said sounds so absurd.
Yeah.
Right? It's like, oh, we can't help people because of the free markets. It's like, no. Because their hammers exist, you can't help people. Like, this is madness.
Yeah. And it comes back a lot to what you're saying around the intentionality of things, which is really something that's echoing through this conversation for me in a really deep way.
Actually, maybe this will tie up this section in a bow, which is that, you know, like sometimes they call economics the dismal science. But economics is not a science. Economics is a design discipline. And we've just done a terrible job of designing the economy, right? There's a million ways to design an economy, and we've done a terrible job at it. And because we treat it like a science, because in science, there actually is foundational truth. If you want to understand how photosynthesis works or why the earth goes around the sun or what have you, there is a foundational truth to it. You can keep on investigating. You will find the truth. In design disciplines, that's not the case. Like, there's a million ways to design anything. Think about any chairs you've sat in, right? A million ways to design chairs, right? A million ways to design an economy. And because we have pretended that economics is a science, and this is really just for the ego of economists, because economists like want to be able to go, you know, ordain their name in some equation in a textbook and say, I was the one who discovered this sort of frontier theory on da-da-da. It's like, guys, no, it's a design discipline. It's like you getting super excited that you designed a particular chair. Like, great. But like, it turns out that enough people sat in that chair and it made all the poor people poorer. So maybe your chair sucks, actually. It doesn't matter how many equations you've tied to it. So like, because we've allowed those people to talk about their discipline like it's a science, then we've also made a lot of foundational errors as well.
Yeah, that I hear that echoing certain things that I've been finding in behavioral psychology as well, just in my natural curiosities on this Inspired Evolution podcast, is, you know, there's a lot of people that, when you start unpacking just some of the research that's done, and people have dedicated their entire lives to certain bodies of research within behavioral sciences and, even just neurological development. And something such as grit, you know, it's like someone can win like a prize around, hey, coming up with grit, but really it is just a different type of like assertiveness. But yet someone's committed their whole career to something called grit. And so now it's this whole new field, when really it shares a lot of the synonyms of what was previously there. But yet, because someone's identity is attached to it, you said the word ego, you know, now it's this whole new field that we have to cater for. And it's pretty remarkable how our how the dimensions of our mind and our personalities play out into the constructs of the world we live in. So, question, Tom. There's a few big things in there. I'd love to sort of ground into some questions around how do you navigate your relationship with, you know, and I'm obviously aware of your relationship with the work that you do in the world, but how do you navigate your way through the current capitalistic model? How do you find your best, most empowered relationship with it? How do you stay empowered knowing what you know about the nature of the way things are and yet maintain a sort of empowered, positive relationship with the world that you're living in?
Yeah. So like I said, capitalism is a tool and it's a tool around making things more efficient. And I'm a person with a background in physics, electrical engineering, a bunch of technical subjects, software engineering, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, what we do in our firm is we basically look for disruptive technologies that have both radically better unit economics and radically better environmental economics so that we can work toward a world where humanity is a net positive to nature. And, you know, you say working with capitalism, well, it turns out that actually, if you make something with better unit economics, it actually wins, right? You don't need to go, you know, protest at City Hall or, you know, be upset at COP26 or, you know, whatever, you know, is the latest thing that is happening on that front. And I'm actually not against people doing that either. Like sometimes that's the only voice that you have. It's the only way to go in. Express what needs, you know, what you need to say. But like me personally, as a person who has invented this type of tech, you know, and has like raised capital to be able to support this type of tech, you know, I have another tool in the toolkit, which is I can go and find these things that have much better unit economics, much better environmental economics, and we can redo the industrial economy so that you know, our presence on the planet is positive for nature instead of destructive for nature. And that would actually be driven by capitalism as well. It's just using the hammer more effectively.
It's remarkable to hear you articulate that, because even as you're sharing that, I can feel the blockages in my mind just because Yeah, there's just so much conditioning, I guess, that sort of pairs a lot of the problems we have with the capitalistic model already that I, and potentially I speak on behalf of some of those that are listening in, can't speak on behalf of everybody, but you genuinely see a world where we can actually be a regenerative force as a humanity for the planet using the tools that we've got in place. Can you paint the picture for us a little
bit? There's a foundational consumption narrative around our damage to the earth, which is the whole limits to growth narrative, where we basically said, well, world population's getting too big, and given that, we can't be sustainable. It's just some flavor of damage we're going to need to do. And I have a talk where I basically speak to this, which is, well, it turns out that the biomass of humans on the planet is roughly the same as the biomass of ants on the planet. So if you took all the humans and put them on a scale and you weighed them against all the ants on the planet, the scale would roughly balance, just about as much total biomass. But one thing about humans is they eat about 3% of their body weight per day, and ants eat 30% of their body weight per day, 10 times more. So given that there's the same amount of us in terms of mass, but they eat 30% of their body weight per day and we eat 3%, they actually literally consume 10 times more of the planet than humans do. And yet we're not sitting around thinking about like, oh, ants, man, ant overpopulation destroying the world. No, no, no. They're actually out there literally consuming 10 times more of the planet. It's just, it's not the amount, it's the style. And in fact, plants actually do more, bacteria do more. There's lots of organisms that consume way more of the planet than us, actually. But the style in which they do it is they actually add more ecosystem services than they take in the process of eating. And we can do that. There's no physics reasons that we can't do it. I mean, bacteria and ants and plants have already shown us. There's no physics reason that we can't actually add more ecosystem services than we take in the process of consuming that much. And like I said, we consume way less than ants. So to the extent that we can get even just a little bit closer to what ants are pulling off, and I feel like we're smart enough to do it, we've chosen to be dumb, and we've systematically chosen to be dumb. You know, that's what has made it so pernicious for such a long time period. But if go ahead.
Sorry to interrupt you. The decision to be dumb, is that us, like, is the interface of that comfort and convenience, is that really what's at the heart of it, in your opinion? Or is that just my opinion? What are your thoughts on why are we choosing to be dumb?
Part of it is that we get sold on these narratives that, like, well, it's us or them. So, like, think about this, you know, 100 years ago, we had a bunch of world wars, right? So it's like clearly very recently in human history, we're a very us and them kind of society. Even now, like, you know, as people are like, oh, China's the big economic threat, that's basically Cold War language, right? So it's like, this is us failing the conscious evolution game, when in practice, like, you know, so if you start from that world, then you start thinking it's like, well, these folks have access to these resources and these folks have access to those resources. And, you know, what if we, like, you know, annex Crimea in order to get these resources and control these pipelines? It's like, that's the general thought process that's in mind. Now, is there anything intrinsic in the physical universe that says you need to have those thought processes? Of course not, right? Like, that those are thought processes that we decided to take on. That's some of the dumbness that is here. And we can choose to take on other thought processes, which are actually based on how the physical world works. Like, so for example, like the phrase survival of the fittest basically got all over the place, right? And that basically, you know, helped to fuel the sense where it's like, well, we're all in competition against each other. And it's like whoever is like the most vicious, or like who's got the most power or whatever, like those are the, you know, that's just the nature of life. Like, the nature of life is to go and like for power. I'm just going to tell you that the majority of biomass on the planet is plants, and 80% of plants are angiosperms, which are obligate mutualists, which means the majority of life on the planet is cooperative. Right? And if you understand the majority of life on the planet is obligate mutualists, they have to be cooperative to live. then it doesn't it give you a different sense than survival of the fittest? Mm-hmm. And think about how much of our economy and our political science and everything that we talk about, our philosophy, we've built off of this survival of the fittest bullshit. White supremacy, all these things are basically survival of the fittest kind of ideas. And that's actually not true of how life works on the planet. So like our foundational narratives, you know, we've adopted a bunch of actually pretty dumb foundational narratives. We said, well, it's the laws of nature. And it's like, these people are not scientists. They don't understand nature, right? I probably need to explain to them what an obligate mutualist is. And it's like, okay, well, you know, let's stop listening to that. That's dumb. Like that, we can be a lot better than that. And we actually already know better than that. Like everything I'm telling you is stuff that we've known for a while.
One of the things that's echoing in the back of my head is, when you're talking about cooperation, the clear thing, the imagery that came to mind was when I was reading Sapiens by Yuval Hariri. He talks about, just imagine for a second, a whole bunch of gorillas in a stadium watching a football match, and how like their ability to do that and inability to do that versus a bunch of humans sitting in a football stadium, like 200,000 million people sitting in a football stadium, and their ability to sit there and do that. And then looking at the evolution of how far they've gotten and how far we've gotten and how integral cooperation is to us as a species, and how it speaks to the undercurrent of how we've been able to achieve what we have with our relationship.
When anybody says like, oh, that's just how nature works, or that's just human nature, that is basically them abdicating their responsibility to be part of creating a great society together.
How important, sorry, another left field question, is the story? Because I can feel tuning into this podcast already, and we're not quite at the end, but you know, I feel that really what I'm hearing is that there is an opportunity for a whole new story for the way that we view the world and the relationship of humanity with the planet, humanity with each other, and just our relationship with our consciousness. And I think that's probably the little place where I'm trying to interject, where I know how much of an impact stories have on us and our consciousness and our relationship with the world. Do you see that as being a key piece for us?
Yeah, you know, I actually told, you know, that story at A-Fest a number of years ago. And you can look up the talk. It's basically,
I'll put it in the links to the show.
Yeah, everything is connected. Here's how. And I basically describe from the formation of the universe, you know, effectively how all of us are connected to each other and the universe at large. And it is basically just, you know, I'm organizing facts in a sequence, and you can call that a story, but you can also just say like, no, actually scientifically, this is what happened. Like the universe is actually tending toward, you know, more intelligence, more, you know, more beneficial complexity, more mutualistic, actually. That has been the entire arc of life in the universe. And it's like, for us to go make up a bunch of local systems about our sense of separation and why we can't get things done when the arc of the entire universe is the opposite. That's us, yeah, no, really willfully trying to be ignorant. And of course, you know, I'm not trying to go and have people feel bad, because it's like, oh, you're living in this tough time and now I'm calling you dumb. It's like, no, it's not, you know, any individual person that is this. It's just that we have bought into a set of narratives, you know, hustle culture, where it's like, oh, everybody, that is a survival of the fittest offshoot, right? Like take all these things where it's like, look at all the things that are actually damaging our physical and psychological health. I can point you to the narratives that we adopted 10 years ago, 100 years ago, 1,000 years ago, that have stuck with us, and they're actually not physically true at all. You know, they're not based on how the actual physical universe works. And as I've said before, it's like, I'm a physicist, I'm like reasonably familiar with how the physical universe works. So like when these things don't line up, then yeah, I call them out a little bit, and that's what you'll see in the talk. So I basically try to cover how the entire universe and life formed, and also the meaning of life, in about 34 minutes.
Just casually. But Tom did an amazing, super inspirational talk, by the way. I I remember feeling that. So it's not just about us being interconnected in like the spiritual sense, but actually in the physical sense, and then leaving the talk going, holy crap, like I am stardust, but not like just like as a thought, but just like as like a visceral, like everything's a miracle. Like I'm actually made up of stardust.
Exactly. And like that the spiritual, at least in this instance, is very much based on what is also physically true. Now you can make up some spiritual stuff where it's like, nah, not that particular story from this spiritual tradition, probably not true. But like the thing that appears in a lot of spiritual traditions is the sense that we are all connected. And that is literally true. And in the talk, I basically go and describe exactly how. And then, and honestly, you know, is that even required? It's not necessarily required. I think it's nice though that science has given us the lens recently that we can go and fully verify a thing that we have spiritually found to be a compelling idea for a very long time.
I love that. Thank you so much for sharing that. One of my other questions is, we talked about our relationship with capitalism and how to potentially upgrade that into a positive narrative. Now, I'd love to sort of glean some insight from your world as well, in terms of your relationship with some of the more attention hungry softwares, potentially social media, that sort of stuff. How do you manage your relationship with that for the listener? How do we navigate that relationship in our lives? What do you do that may be supportive to us?
Yeah. Let me see. So I have, there's this game called Neko Atsumi, also called like cat collector or kitty collector. And all you do is you like you buy things and then it attracts cats. You don't actually need to use real money because the cats give you money. But sounds ridiculous, but you know, I have two cats and I like them. And it's, and I find that like, honestly, playing the thing is as enjoyable and probably more enjoyable to me than social media. And it does exactly the same thing that social media does. It's like a thing that allows you to take like a 30 second break, you know, to get like a little reward. And then like, then you can like put it away. Like it's, it is not filled with QAnon theories. It's not filled with madness. It's just, you get to see some cute cats like playing with, you know, like a, play, like a little like box that you put in the field. So like, I don't know. I mean, that sounds ridiculous. Like I bet if I was like the, my mom is a Buddhist, so I should probably be a better meditator. You know, I went to temple and all these sorts of things when I was young. But like, you know, I bet if I was like, you know, amazingly like well-trained or whatever, I like would not even be vaguely tempted. But like, you know, you get into it a little bit. It is part of the modern world. It's a little bit hard to avoid seeing anything on social media. And, but like when I find that like I'm out of whack, then it's like, oh, let me go take care of my little digital cats. That only takes like a minute and basically gives me a better feeling than what actual social media is.
Yep. Because there's that whole aspect to social media as well, where people are consistently posting the best parts of their lives and we end up benchmarking ourselves against that. And then it can be this consistent living up to aspect of it. Whereas I like what you're articulating is, even if it still is your device, it's this opportunity to just cultivate a relationship that doesn't have to be so judgmental.
You know, actually like going deep on that for a second, it's like, you know, the best part of our lives, the word best is the use of a superlative, right? And what I find is that the superlative tends to be reductive and it makes you think, you know, less effectively, makes you less of a person.
Sure.
Right. Cause if for example, I told you, if I asked you a superlative question, like what's the very best song you've ever heard? Well, all of a sudden it like makes you need to like devalue so many songs, whatever answer you come up with. There's like so many other songs that have been incredibly meaningful in your life that have given you so much and you've devalued all of them because this one is the best.
Yeah.
What I will say is that the superlative is a type of brain damage, right? Like when we try to apply the superlative to anything, it's actually reducing the cognitive scope of, of kind of expression that we're able to take on. And I've had the benefit, bringing this back down to regular words and stuff, because I know it's a a little heady, but it's like, I've had the privilege in my life to, you know, be a real smart person that got to work with a lot of really smart people. And, you know, people are like, oh, you know, this person's a genius. You got to work with them. That person's a genius. And it's true. Actually, a bunch of the people I've worked with are actual geniuses. But because I've like been able to work with so many geniuses, like I understand how many flavors of genius there is. And the idea that there's a type of best genius is like a crazy idea. It means like, oh, I'm going to miss this person. I'm going to miss this person that has this way of words because I've like opted for this person who's got this way with equations. You know, that's crazy, right? So like, I think like if we start to, the antidote to that is just to understand that the superlative is brain damage. That like comparison is basically the kind of assistant to the superlative, right? Because it's like, oh, I went into social media, compared. Well, why are you comparing? Because I'm trying to figure out who's the best. Right. And so it's like you're basically assisting a type of brain damage there. And at the end of the day, like what's actually true is there are a million ways to be smart, and there's a million ways to be beautiful, and there's a million ways to be all these things that we want to express in life. And actually, the thing that makes us happiest is basically deepening our ability to appreciate. And I find that concept is different than gratitude. Gratitude is like a thing already happened and I like want to go reflect on it. And I'm not saying gratitude's bad. That's great too. Gratitude, cool, like it. But I think actually an even more powerful capability than gratitude is appreciation. That whatever this thing is, even if nobody in the world said it would be the best by anybody's kind of, you know, like a ladder of superlative, that I found a way to appreciate it. Like people that are good at appreciation are the people that are good at happiness. And like all these other things, like the goals that are superlative based, like once I get to this and become the best at so-and-so, or become the best in my school at so-and-so, or the best at whatever, those are, that's basically the skill of unhappiness.
Wow. The discernment between gratitude and appreciation, yeah, I can feel there's a whole layer of humility woven into the type of appreciation that you're describing, because if you can humble yourself, even a blade of grass can teach you. But that's the appreciation that that's profound. Thank you for sharing.
You know, there's an exercise, you know, and not that these should all be broken into exercises and retreats and whatever too, because that's like the
why not?
Well, I don't know. That's maybe capitalism run amok on personal development. But like, you know, there's an exercise that basically says, take out a timer, set it for 5 minutes, and spend 5 minutes eating one grape. And man, if you do it, you will find so many things to appreciate. Like the bitterness of the outer coat of the seed. And there's like a little slimy part on the outer part of the seed before you get into the inner part of the seed, which is actually has the astringency in it. You know, like the depth of complexity in the skin of the grape, right? That there's like 10 flavors in the skin of a grape. The sort of thing that like you would mindlessly do in 3 seconds, you know, eating a grape. And you know, it doesn't need to be that exercise, but like whatever exercise that you come up with or whatever practice that you come up with that strengthens what appreciation muscles you have. And related to all this stuff, a lot of social media is about comparison and beauty. And like my kind of redefinition of beauty is that if you are healthy and you are passionate about life, then that is beautiful. And I like it so much more than any aesthetic. You know, I feel like aesthetics are good for commerce. But like, you know, being healthy and being passionate about life, that is yours. You don't need commerce for that to exist.
Wow, I love that. That's super beautiful. That gently brings me to my last question, Tom. So what is your vision for yourself, for the humanity, for potentially the planet, for the universe? Like what is, when you think of inspired evolution, what do you think is an inspired evolution for yourself or for us as a collective? What do you see?
So I think there is a kind of catching up with all the other organisms, because they're all on it. I mentioned ants before, but really every organism on the planet that has lasted, you know, until now you know, it's lasted because it is a net positive to nature, right? Like its life helps to advance life on the planet, right? A bunch of like little critters like make the soil healthy, you know, a bunch of, you know, all the plants on the planet like make it so that the above ground and soil ecosystems are able to thrive. Like everything on this planet basically serves, you know, so much other life around it. And only us, like locally in recent times, have become so selfish or have been acting on a type of selfishness, because I don't think we're intrinsically need to be selfish. This is the selfishness that we have is the natural conclusion of the weird beliefs that we've adopted around survival of the fittest and all these other things, which are actually just not true to how the universe works. So I think like my vision is that like we wake up to some of these things which are just true. You know, I do some talks about this because I hope that it helps people wake up to those things. And then that we actually redo our economy and society with that in mind, that like our presence on the planet should be a net positive to all of nature. And humanity should also be a net positive to humanity, that our presence should not be against other people, you know, no matter what nationality, no matter what background we came from. Like we need to go find ways to be net positives to each other. And, you know, look, you want to go have a local competition because you want to go see the Super Bowl or something, fine. Like go make a game of it. But like recognize that that is a game. That is an artificial thing that is a little fun to do for a bit. Don't go and design an entire economy around a game as stupid, or geopolitical matters on things that are that stupid, or global resource extraction around things that are that stupid. Like we can do so much better. We are already capable of doing so much better. And this is not even like because humans are so superior. Like I said, all the other animals and organisms already figured this out. They're already living it. It's like in every one of their cells. So I think like, you know, to the extent that we kind of first catch up, and then we can use the intelligence that we do have, you know, that is interesting in some ways, to be able to go and bring that same sensibility to all corners of the civilization that we create. And even that kind of like, you know, the whole like, oh, we got to go to Mars and become a planetary, multi-planetary species. You know, what I say is like, we should go to other planets at the point in time where we become the sort of civilization that is good at treating planets well. We are not that civilization right now. The idea that like, oh, we're going to go there because there's such great mining opportunities on Mars. It's like, oh God, like, can you have a shorter form way to go show that our consciousness is not quite ready to go to other places yet, when the first thing that we think of is economic resource extraction? Like we can do better, and it doesn't even take that much, you know?
Wow. I resonate so deeply with what you're sharing. Thank you so much for sharing your vision with us. And Tom, not just your vision, thank you so much for sharing so much of yourself with us here today. It's an absolute pleasure to have you on. Just tune into all the insights, and you can feel, or I feel personally, and I can know I speak on the behalf of the Inspired Evolution tribe and audience, that yeah, some of the things that, you know, we've talked about today, it goes that level deeper. There's like an actual intentionality behind why it is that the way things are, and actually questioning and unpick that. And I know one of your things is knowing is the enemy of learning. And that's really been really powerful. I've heard that so much in the subtext of everything that we've talked about today. It's like bringing it back to potentially first principles and unpicking it. And I just want to thank you for taking the time and energy to do that in so many dimensions of your own experience of life, so that we can have such a warm, enriched and powerful conversation. Thank you so much for doing this with us today.
Thank you.
And as always, on behalf of myself and the Inspired Evolution tribe and audience, wishing you the best for everything that's coming up. Thanks again, Tom, and I hope to do this again with you sometime soon. Thank you so much for tuning into this amazing episode of the Inspired Evolution. Without you, the Inspired Evolution tribe, this podcast would not be what it is today. Thank you so much for your love and your support. Thank you so much for being so inspired to evolve. It's truly inspiring. If you haven't already done so, please subscribe to the Inspired Evolution on YouTube, the home of the Inspired Evolution's video podcast.
We release inspiring conversations such as this every week, along with guided meditations and empowering insights, all designed to help you grow and evolve. Honestly, your subscription on YouTube to the channel helps us out a great deal. And one of the other benefits, if you're having any insights or shifts from these episodes that you want to chat about, or if you'd like to leave myself or the guest a message, please do so in the comments on YouTube. I truly look forward to hearing from you. And as always, Tribe, remember to stay inspired and keep evolving.
Catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.